Zurich. Einstein was pictured so often with his stepdaughters, but never with his sons, Besso noted. Why didn't he travel with them? Perhaps he could take Eduard on one of his trips to America and get to know him better. Einstein loved Eduard. Elsa told a friend, "This sorrow is eating up Albert." But he felt that Eduard's schizophrenia was inherited from his mother's side, as to some extent it probably was, and there was little that he could do about it. That was also the reason he resisted psychoanalysis for Eduard. He considered it ineffective, especially in cases of severe mental illness that seemed to have hereditary causes. Besso, on the other hand, had gone through psychoanalysis, and in his letter he was expansive and disarming, just as he had been back when they used to walk home from the patent office together more than a quarter century earlier. He had his own problems in marriage, Besso said, referring to Anna Vintola, whom Einstein had introduced him to. But by forging a better relationship with his own son, he had made his marriage work and his life more meaningful. Einstein replied that he hoped to take Eduard with him to visit Princeton. "Unfortunately, everything indicates that strong heredity manifests itself very definitely," he lamented. "I have seen that coming slowly but inexorably since Tete's youth. Outside influences play only a small part in such cases, compared to internal secretions, about which nobody can do anything." The tug was there, and Einstein knew that he had to and wanted to see Eduard. He was supposed to visit Oxford in late May, but he decided to delay the trip for a week so that he could go to Zurich and be with his son. "I could not wait 6 weeks before going to see him," he wrote Lindemann, asking his indulgence. "You are not a father, but I know you will understand." His relationship with Marit had improved so much that when she heard he could not go back to Germany, she invited both him and Elsa to come to Zurich and live in her apartment building. He was pleasantly surprised, and he stayed with her when he came alone that May. But his visit with Eduard turned out to be more wrenching than he had anticipated. Einstein had brought with him his violin. Often he and Eduard had played together, expressing emotions with their music in ways they could not with words. The photograph of them on that visit is particularly poignant. They are sitting awkwardly next to each other, wearing suits, in what seems to be the visiting room of the asylum. Einstein is holding his violin and bow, looking away. Eduard is staring down intensely at a pile of papers, the pain seeming to contort his now fleshy face. When Einstein left Zurich for Oxford, he was still assuming that he would be spending half of each ensuing year in Europe. What he did not know was that, as things would turn out, this would be the last time he would see his first wife and their younger son. While at Oxford, Einstein gave his Herbert Spencer lecture, in which he explained his philosophy of science, and then went to Glasgow, where he gave an account of his path toward the discovery of general relativity. He enjoyed the trip so much that soon after his return to Le Coq-sur-Mer, he decided to go back to England in late July, this time at the invitation of one of his unlikeliest acquaintances. British Commander Oliver Locker Lamson was most things that Einstein was not. The adventurous son of a Victorian poet, he became a World War I aviator, leader of an armored division in Lapland and Russia, an advisor to Grand Duke Nicholas, and potential plotter in the murder of Rasputin. Now he was a barrister, journalist, and member of Parliament. He'd studied in Germany, knew the language and the people, and had become, perhaps as a consequence, an early advocate for preparing to fight the Nazis. With an appetite for the interesting, he began writing Einstein, whom he had met only in passing once at Oxford, asking him to be his guest in England. When Einstein accepted his offer, the dashing commander made the most of it. He took Einstein to see Winston Churchill, then suffering through his wilderness years as an opposition member of Parliament. At lunch in the gardens of Churchill's home, Chartwell, they discussed Germany's rearmament. "He is an eminently wise man," Einstein wrote Elsa that day. "It became clear to me that these people have made preparations and are determined to act resolutely and soon." It sounded like an assessment from someone who had just eaten lunch with Churchill. Locker Lamson also brought Einstein to Austen Chamberlain, another advocate of rearmament, and former Prime Minister Lloyd George. When he arrived at the home of the latter, Einstein was given the guest book to sign. When he got to the space for home address, he paused for a few moments, then wrote, "Ohne," without any. Locker Lamson recounted the incident the next day, when, with great flourish, he introduced a bill in Parliament, as Einstein watched from the visitors' gallery, wearing a white linen suit, to extend opportunities of citizenship for Jews. Germany was in the process of destroying its culture and threatening the safety of its greatest thinkers. She has turned out her most glorious citizen, Albert Einstein, he said. When he is asked to put his address in visitors' books, he has to write, "Without any." How proud this country must be to have offered him shelter at Oxford. When he returned to his seaside cottage in Belgium, Einstein decided there was one issue he should clear up, or at least try to, before he embarked for America again. The women patriots and others were still seeking to bar him as a dangerous subversive or communist, and he found their allegations to be both offensive and potentially problematic. Because of his socialist sentiments, history of pacifism, and opposition to fascism, it was thought then, and throughout his life, that Einstein might be sympathetic to the Russian communists. Nor did it help that he had an earnest willingness to lend his name to almost any worthy-sounding manifesto or masthead that arrived in his mail, without always determining whether the groups involved might be fronts for other agendas. Fortunately, his willingness to lend his name to sundry organizations was accompanied by an aversion to actually showing up for any meetings or spending time in comradely planning sessions. So there were not many political groups, and certainly no communist ones, in which he actually participated. And he made it a point never to visit Russia, because he knew that he could be used for propaganda purposes. As his departure date neared, Einstein gave two interviews to make these points clear. "I am a convinced Democrat," he told fellow German refugee Leo Lania for the New York World Telegram. "It is for this reason that I do not go to Russia, although I have received very cordial invitations. My voyage to Moscow would certainly be exploited by the rulers of the Soviets to profit their own political aims. Now, I am an adversary of Bolshevism just as much as of fascism. I am against all dictatorships." In another interview, which appeared both in the Times of London and the New York Times, Einstein admitted that occasionally he had been fooled by organizations that pretended to be purely pacifist or humanitarian, but are, in truth, nothing less than camouflaged propaganda in the service of Russian despotism. He emphasized, "I have never favored communism and do not favor it now." The essence of his political belief was to oppose any power that enslaves the individual by terror and force, whether it arises under a fascist or communist flag. These statements were made, no doubt, to tamp down any controversy in America about his alleged political leanings. But they had the added virtue of being true. He had occasionally been duped by groups whose agendas were not what they seemed, but he had, since childhood, kept as his guiding principle an aversion to authoritarianism, whether of the left or the right. At the end of the summer, Einstein received some devastating news. Having recently separated from his wife and collaborator, his friend Paul Ehrenfest had gone to visit his 16-year-old son, who was in an Amsterdam institution with Down syndrome. He pulled out a gun, shot the boy in the face, taking out his eye but not killing him. Then he turned the gun on himself and committed suicide. More than 20 years earlier, Ehrenfest, a wandering young Jewish physicist, had shown up in Prague, where Einstein was working, and asked for help finding a job. After visiting the cafes and talking physics for hours that day, the two men became deeply devoted friends. Ehrenfest's mind was very different from Einstein's in many ways. He had an almost morbid lack of self-confidence, Einstein said, and was better at critically poking holes in existing theories than at building new ones. That made him a good teacher, the best I have ever known. But his sense of inadequacy, objectively unjustified, plagued him incessantly. But there was one important way in which he was like Einstein. He could never make his peace with quantum mechanics. To learn and teach things that one cannot fully accept in one's heart is always a difficult matter, Einstein wrote of Ehrenfest, doubly difficult for a man of fanatical honesty. Einstein, who knew what it was like to turn 50, followed this with a description that said as much about his own approach to quantum mechanics as it did about Ehrenfest's. Added to this was the increasing difficulty of adapting to new thoughts, which always confronts the man past 50. I do not know how many readers of these lines will be capable of fully grasping that tragedy. Einstein was. Ehrenfest's suicide deeply unnerved Einstein, as did the increased intensity of the threats against his own life. His name had been falsely associated with a book attacking Hitler's terror. As was often the case, he had let his name be used as the honorary chair of a committee, which then published the book, but he had not read any of it. German papers headlined, "Einstein's Infamy," in red letters. One magazine pictured him on a list of enemies of the German regime, listed his crimes, and concluded with the phrase, "Not yet hanged." So Einstein decided to take Locker Lamson up on his English hospitality yet again for the final month before his scheduled departure for America in October. Elsa, who wanted to stay behind in Belgium to pack, asked a reporter from the Sunday Express to arrange for Einstein to get to England safely. Being a good journalist, he accompanied Einstein on the trip himself and reported that on the Channel crossing, Einstein pulled out his notebook and went to work on his equations. In a drama worthy of a James Bond movie, Locker Lamson had two young female assistants take Einstein up to a secluded cottage he owned that was nestled on a coastal moor northeast of London. There he was swept into a slapstick whirl of secrecy and publicity. The two young women posed next to him holding hunting shotguns for a picture that was given to the press agencies, and Locker Lamson declared, "If any unauthorized person comes near, they will get a charge of buckshot." Einstein's own assessment of his security was less intimidating. "The beauty of my bodyguards would disarm a conspirator sooner than their shotguns," he told a visitor. Among those who penetrated this modest security perimeter were a former foreign minister who wanted to discuss the crisis in Europe, Einstein's stepson-in-law, Dmitry Marianov, who had come to interview him for an article he had sold to a French publication, Walter Meyer, who helped continue the Sisyphean task of finding unified field theory equations, and the noted sculptor Jacob Epstein, who spent 3 days making a beautiful bust of Einstein. The only one who ran afoul of the female guards was Epstein, who asked if they would take one of the doors off its hinges so he could get a better angle for his sculpting. "They facetiously asked whether I would like the roof off next," he recalled. "I thought I should have liked that too, but I did not demand it, as the attendant angels seemed to resent a little my intrusion into the retreat of their professor." After 3 days, however, the guardians warmed to Epstein, and everyone began drinking beer together at the end of his sittings. Einstein's humor stayed intact through it all. Among the letters he received in England was one from a man who had a theory that gravity meant that as the earth rotated, people were sometimes upside down or horizontal. Perhaps that led people to do foolish things, he speculated, like falling in love. "Falling in love is not the most stupid thing that people do," Einstein scribbled on the letter, "but gravitation cannot be held responsible for it." Einstein's main appearance on this trip was a speech on October 3rd in London's Royal Albert Hall, which was designed to raise money for displaced German scholars. Some suspected, no doubt with reason, that Locker Lamson had hyped the security threat and publicity about Einstein's hideaway in order to promote ticket sales. If so, he was successful. All 9,000 seats were filled, and others jammed the aisles and lobbies. 1,000 students acted as guides and guards against any pro-Nazi demonstration that might materialize. None did. Einstein spoke in English about the current menace to freedom, but he was careful not to attack the German regime specifically. "If we want to resist the powers that threaten to suppress intellectual and individual freedom, we must be clear what is at stake," he said. "Without such freedom, there would have been no Shakespeare, no Goethe, no Newton, no Faraday, no Pasteur, no Lister. Freedom was a foundation for creativity." He also spoke of the need for solitude. The monotony of a quiet life stimulates the creative mind, he said. And he repeated a suggestion he had made when younger that scientists might be employed as lighthouse keepers so they could devote themselves undisturbed to thinking. It was a revealing remark. For Einstein, science was a solitary pursuit, and he seemed not to realize that for others it could be far more fruitful when pursued collaboratively. In Copenhagen and elsewhere, the quantum mechanics team had been building on each other's ideas with a frenzy. But Einstein's great breakthroughs had been those that could be done with perhaps just an occasional sounding board and mathematical assistant by someone in a barren patent office, the garret of a Berlin apartment, or a lighthouse. The ocean liner Westmoreland, which had sailed from Antwerp with Elsa and Helen Dukas aboard, picked up Einstein and Walter Meyer in Southampton on October 7, 1933. He did not think he would be away for long. In fact, he planned to spend another term at Christchurch, Oxford, the next spring. But although he would live for another 22 years, Einstein would never see Europe again. Chapter 19 America 1933 to 1939 Princeton. The ocean liner Westmoreland, which carried Einstein at age 54 to what would become his new home country, arrived in New York Harbor on October 17, 1933. Waiting to meet him in the rain at the 23rd Street Pier was an official committee led by his friend Samuel Untermeyer, a prominent attorney, who carried some orchids he had grown, plus a group of cheerleaders that was scheduled to parade him to a welcoming pageant. Einstein and his entourage, however, were nowhere to be found. Abraham Flexner, the director of the Institute for Advanced Studies, was obsessed with shielding him from publicity, whatever Einstein's quirky preferences might be. So he had sent a tugboat with two Institute trustees to spirit Einstein away from the Westmoreland as soon as it cleared quarantine. Make no statement and give no interviews on any subject, he had cabled. To reiterate the message, he sent a letter with one of the trustees who greeted Einstein's ship. Your safety in America depends upon silence and refraining from attendance at public functions, it said. Carrying his violin case with a profusion of hair poking out from a wide-brimmed black hat, Einstein surreptitiously disembarked onto the tug, which then ferried him and his party to the Battery, where a car was waiting to whisk them to Princeton. All Dr. Einstein wants is to be left in peace and quiet, Flexner told reporters. Actually, he also wanted a newspaper and an ice cream cone. So as soon as he had checked into Princeton's Peacock Inn, he changed into casual clothes and, smoking his pipe, went walking to a newsstand, where he bought an afternoon paper and chuckled over the headlines about the mystery of his whereabouts. Then he walked into an ice cream parlor, the Baltimore, pointed his thumb at the cone a young divinity student had just bought, and then pointed at himself. As the waitress made change for him, she announced, "This one goes into my memory book." Einstein was given a corner office in a university hall that served as the temporary headquarters of the Institute. There were 18 scholars in residence then, including the mathematicians Oswald Veblen, nephew of the social theorist Thorsten Veblen, and John von Neumann, a pioneer of computer theory. When shown his office, he was asked what equipment he might need. "A desk or table, a chair, paper and pencils," he replied. "Oh, yes, and a large wastebasket, so I can throw away all my mistakes." He and Elsa soon found a house to rent, which they celebrated by hosting a small musical recital featuring the works of Haydn and Mozart. The noted Russian violinist Tosha Seidel played lead, with Einstein as second fiddle. In return for some violin tips, Einstein tried to explain relativity theory to Seidel and made him some drawings of moving rods contracting in length. Thus began a proliferation of popular tales in town involving Einstein's love for music. One involved Einstein playing in a quartet with violin virtuoso Fritz Kreisler. At a certain point, they got out of sync. Kreisler stopped playing and turned to Einstein in mock exasperation. "What's the matter, Professor? Can't you count?" More poignantly, there was an evening where a Christian prayer group gathered to make intercessions for persecuted Jews. Einstein surprised them by asking if he could come. He brought his violin, and as if offering a prayer, played a solo. Many of his performances were purely impromptu. That first Halloween, he disarmed some astonished trick-or-treaters, a group of 12-year-old girls who had come with the intent of playing a prank, by appearing at the door and serenading them with his violin. And at Christmas time, when members of the First Presbyterian Church came by to sing carols, he stepped out into the snow, borrowed a violin from one of the women, and accompanied them. "He was just a lovely person," one of them recalled. Einstein soon acquired an image, which grew into a near legend but was nevertheless based on reality, of being a kindly and gentle professor, distracted at times but unfailingly sweet, who wandered about lost in thought, helped children with their homework, and rarely combed his hair or wore socks. With his amused sense of self-awareness, he catered to such perceptions. "I'm a kind of ancient figure known primarily for his non-use of socks, and wheeled out on special occasions as a curiosity," he joked. His slightly disheveled appearance was partly an assertion of his simplicity, and partly a mild act of rebellion. "I have reached an age when, if someone tells me to wear socks, I don't have to," he told a neighbor. His baggy, comfortable clothes became a symbol of his lack of pretense. He had a leather jacket, which he tended to wear to events both formal and informal. When a friend found out that he had a mild allergy to wool sweaters, she went to a surplus store and bought him some cotton sweatshirts, which he wore all the time. And his dismissive attitude toward haircuts and grooming was so infectious that Elsa, Margot, and his sister Maya all sported the same disheveled gray profusion. He was able to make his rumpled genius image as famous as Chaplin did the Little Tramp. He was kindly, yet aloof, brilliant, yet baffled. He floated around with a distracted air and a wry sensibility. He exuded honesty to a fault, was sometimes, but not always, as naive as he seemed, cared passionately about humanity, and sometimes about people. He would fix his gaze on cosmic truths and global issues, which allowed him to seem detached from the here and now. This role he played was not far from the truth, but he enjoyed playing it to the hilt, knowing that it was such a great role. He had also by then adapted willingly to the role Elsa played, that of a wife who could be both doting and demanding, protective, yet afflicted with occasional social aspirations. They had grown comfortable together, after some rough patches. "I manage him," she said proudly, "but I never let him know that I manage him." Actually, he knew, and he found it mildly amusing. He surrendered, for example, to Elsa's nagging that he smoked too much, and on Thanksgiving bet her that he would be able to abstain from his pipe until the new year. When Elsa boasted of this at a dinner party, Einstein grumbled, "You see, I'm no longer a slave to my pipe, but I am a slave to that woman." Einstein kept his word, but he got up at daylight on New Year's morning, and he hasn't had the pipe out of his mouth since except to eat and sleep, Elsa told neighbors a few days after the deal was over. The greatest source of friction for Einstein came from Flexner's desire to protect him from publicity. Einstein was, as always, less fastidious about this than were his friends, patrons, and self-appointed protectors. An occasional flash of the limelight made his eyes twinkle. More important, he was willing and even eager to endure such indignities if he could use his fame to raise money and sympathy for the worsening plight of European Jews. Such political activism made Einstein's penchant for publicity even more disconcerting to Flexner, an old-line and assimilated American Jew. It might provoke anti-Semitism, he thought, especially in Princeton, where the Institute was luring Jewish scholars into an environment that was, to say the least, socially wary of them. Flexner was particularly upset when Einstein, quite charmingly, agreed one Saturday to meet at his home with a group of boys from a Newark school who had named their science club after him. Elsa baked cookies, and when the discussion turned to Jewish political leaders, she noted, "I don't think there is any anti-Semitism in this country." Einstein agreed. It would have amounted to no more than a sweet visit, except that the advisor who accompanied the boys wrote a colorful account, focusing on Einstein's thoughts about the plight of Jews, that was bannered from the top page of the Newark Sunday Ledger. Flexner was furious. "I simply want to protect him," he wrote in a sharp letter to Elsa. And he sent the Newark article to her with a stern note attached. "This is exactly the sort of thing that seems to me absolutely unworthy of Professor Einstein," he scolded. "It will hurt him in the esteem of his colleagues, for they will believe that he seeks such publicity, and I do not see how they can be convinced that such is not the case." Flexner went on to ask Elsa to dissuade her husband from being featured at a scheduled musical recital in Manhattan, which he had already accepted, that was to raise money for Jewish refugees. But like her husband, Elsa was not totally averse to publicity, nor to helping Jewish causes, and she resented Flexner's attempts at control. So she replied with a very frank refusal. That provoked Flexner to send an astonishingly blunt letter the next day, which he noted he had discussed with the president of Princeton University. Echoing the sentiments of some of Einstein's European friends, including the Borns, Flexner warned Elsa that if Jews got too much publicity, it would stoke anti-Semitism. "It is perfectly possible to create anti-Semitic feeling in the United States. There is no danger that any such feeling would be created except by the Jews themselves. There are already signs, which are unmistakable, that anti-Semitism has increased in America. It is because I am myself a Jew, and because I wish to help oppressed Jews in Germany, that my efforts, though continuous and in a measure successful, are absolutely quiet and anonymous. The questions involved are the dignity of your husband and the Institute, according to the highest American standards, and the most effective way of helping the Jewish race in America and in Europe." That same day, Flexner wrote Einstein directly to make the case that Jews like themselves should keep a low profile because a penchant for publicity could arouse anti-Semitism. "I have felt this from the moment that Hitler began his anti-Jewish policy, and I have acted accordingly," he wrote. "There have been indications in American universities that Jewish students and Jewish professors will suffer unless the utmost caution is used." Not surprisingly, Einstein went ahead with his planned benefit recital in Manhattan, for which 264 guests paid $25 apiece to attend. It featured Bach's Concerto for Two Violins in D minor and Mozart's G major quartet. It was even open to the press. "He became so absorbed in the music," Time magazine reported, "that with a faraway look, he was still plucking at the strings when the performance was all over." In his attempt to prevent such events, Flexner had begun intercepting Einstein's mail and declining invitations on his behalf. The stage was thus set for a showdown when Rabbi Stephen Wise of New York decided that it would be a good idea to get Einstein invited to visit President Franklin Roosevelt, which Wise hoped would focus attention on Germany's treatment of Jews. FDR has not lifted a finger on behalf of the Jews of Germany, and this would be little enough, Wise wrote a friend. The result was a telephone call from Roosevelt's social secretary, Colonel Marvin McIntyre, inviting Einstein to the White House. When Flexner found out, he was furious. He called the White House and gave a stern lecture to the somewhat surprised Colonel McIntyre. "All invitations must go through him," Flexner said, and on Einstein's behalf, he declined. For good measure, Flexner proceeded to write an official letter to the president. "I felt myself compelled this afternoon to explain to your secretary," Flexner said, "that Professor Einstein had come to Princeton for the purpose of carrying out his scientific work in seclusion, and that it was absolutely impossible to make any exception which would inevitably bring him into public notice." Einstein knew none of this until Henry Morgenthau, a prominent Jewish leader who was about to become Treasury Secretary, inquired about the apparent snub. Dismayed to discover Flexner's presumption, Einstein wrote to Eleanor Roosevelt, his political soulmate, "You can hardly imagine of what great interest it would have been for me to meet the man who is tackling with gigantic energy the greatest and most difficult problem of our time," he wrote. "However, as a matter of fact, no invitation whatever has reached me." Eleanor Roosevelt answered personally and politely. The confusion came, she explained, because Flexner had been so adamant in his phone call to the White House. "I hope you and Mrs. Einstein will come sometime soon," she added. Elsa responded graciously, First, excuse my poor English, please, she wrote. Dr. Einstein and myself accept with feelings of gratitude your very kind invitation. He and Elsa arrived at the White House on January 24, 1934, had dinner, and spent the night. The president was able to converse with them in passable German. Among other things, they discussed Roosevelt's marine prince and Einstein's love for sailing. The next morning, Einstein wrote an 8-line piece of doggerel on a White House note card to Queen Elizabeth of the Belgians, marking his visit, but he made no public statements. Flexner's interference infuriated Einstein. He complained about it in a letter to Rabbi Wise, on which he put as his return address, Concentration Camp, Princeton, and he sent a 5-page litany of Flexner's meddling to the Institute's trustees. Either they must assure him that there would be no more constant interference of the type that no self-respecting person would tolerate, Einstein threatened, or I would propose that I discuss with you severing my relationship with your institute in a dignified manner. Einstein prevailed, and Flexner backed off. But as a result, he lost his influence with Flexner, whom he would later refer to as one of his few enemies in Princeton. When Erwin Schrödinger, Einstein's fellow traveler in the minefields of quantum mechanics, arrived as a refugee in Princeton that March, he was offered a job at the university. But he wanted instead to be tapped for the Institute of Advanced Studies. Einstein lobbied Flexner on his behalf, but to no avail. Flexner was doing him no more favors, even if it meant depriving the Institute of Schrödinger. During his short stay in Princeton, Schrödinger asked Einstein if he was indeed coming back to Oxford later that spring, as scheduled. He had called himself a bird of passage when heading off to Caltech in 1931, and it was unclear, perhaps even in his own mind, whether he saw this as a liberation or a lament. But now he found himself comfortable in Princeton, with no desire to take wing again. "Why should an old fellow like me not enjoy peace and quiet for once?" he asked his friend Max Born. So he told Schrödinger to pass along his sincere regrets. "I am sorry to say that he asked me to write you a definite no," Schrödinger informed Lindemann. "The reason for his decision is really that he is frightened of all the ado and fuss that would be laid upon him if he came to Europe." Einstein also worried that he would be expected to go to Paris and Madrid if he went to Oxford, and I lack the courage to undertake all this. The stars had aligned to create for Einstein a sense of inertia, or at least a weariness of further wandering. In addition, Princeton, which he called a pipe as yet unsmoked, on his first visit in 1921, captured him with its leafy charm and its neo-Gothic echoes of a European university town. A quaint and ceremonious village of puny demigods strutting on stiff legs, he called it in a letter to Elizabeth, the Queen Mother of Belgium, since the death of the king. "By ignoring certain social conventions, I have been able to create for myself an atmosphere conducive to study and free from distraction." Einstein particularly liked the fact that America, despite its inequalities of wealth and racial injustices, was more of a meritocracy than Europe. "What makes the new arrival devoted to this country is the democratic trait among the people," he marveled. "No one humbles himself before another person or class. This was a function of the right of individuals to say and think what they pleased, a trait that had always been important to Einstein. In addition, the lack of stifling traditions encouraged more creativity of the sort he had relished as a student. American youth has the good fortune not to have its outlook troubled by outworn traditions," he noted. Elsa likewise loved Princeton, which was important to Einstein. She had taken such good care of him for so long that he had become more solicitous of her desires, particularly her nesting instinct. "The whole of Princeton is one great park with wonderful trees," she wrote a friend. "We might almost believe that we are in Oxford." The architecture and countryside reminded her of England, and she felt somewhat guilty that she was so comfortable while others back in Europe were suffering. "We are very happy here, perhaps too happy. Sometimes one has a bad conscience." So, in April 1934, just 6 months after his arrival, Einstein announced that he was staying in Princeton indefinitely, and assuming full-time status at the Institute. As it turned out, he would never live anywhere else for the remaining 21 years of his life. Nevertheless, he made appearances at farewell parties that had been scheduled that month as fundraisers for various of his favorite charities. These causes had become almost as important to him as his science. As he declared at one of the events, "Striving for social justice is the most valuable thing to do in life." Sadly, just when they had decided to settle in, Elsa had to travel back to Europe to care for her spirited and adventurous elder daughter, Ilse, who had dallied with the romantic radical Georg Nicolai and married the literary journalist Rudolf Kaiser. Ilse was afflicted with what they thought was tuberculosis, but which turned out to be leukemia, and her condition had taken a turn for the worse. Now she had gone to Paris to be nursed by her sister Margot. Insisting that her problems were mainly psychosomatic, Ilse resisted medications and turned instead to prolonged psychotherapy. Early during her illness, Einstein had tried to persuade her to go to a regular doctor, but she had refused. Now there was little that could be done, as the whole family, absent Einstein himself, gathered by her bed in Margot's Paris apartment. Ilse's death devastated Elsa. "She changed and aged," Margot's husband recalled, "almost beyond recognition." Instead of having Ilse's ashes deposited in a crypt, Elsa had them put in a sealed bag for her. "I cannot be separated," she said. "I have to have them." She then sewed the bag inside a pillow so that she could have them close to her on the trip home to America. Elsa also carried back cases of her husband's papers, which Margot had earlier smuggled from Berlin to Paris using French diplomatic channels and the anti-Nazi underground. To help get them into America, Elsa enlisted the help of a kindly neighbor from Princeton, Caroline Blackwood, who was on the same ship home. Elsa had met the Blackwoods a few months earlier in Princeton, and they mentioned that they were going to Palestine and Europe and wished to meet some Zionist leaders. "I didn't know you were Jews," Elsa said. Mrs. Blackwood said that they were actually Presbyterian, but there was a deep connection between the Jewish heritage and the Christian, and besides, Jesus was a Jew. Elsa hugged her. "No Christian has ever said that to me in my life." She also asked for help in getting a German language Bible, as they had lost theirs in the move from Berlin. Mrs. Blackwood found her a copy of Martin Luther's translation, which Elsa clasped to her heart. "I wish I had more faith," she told Mrs. Blackwood. Elsa had taken note of what liner the Blackwoods were traveling on, and she purposely booked passage on it when she returned to America. One morning, she brought Mrs. Blackwood into the ship's deserted lounge to ask a favor. Because she was not a citizen, she was afraid that her husband's papers might be held at the border. Would the Blackwoods bring them in? They agreed, although Mr. Blackwood was careful not to lie on his customs declaration. "Material acquired in Europe for scholarly purposes," he wrote. Later, Einstein came over in the rain to the Blackwoods' shed to collect his papers. "Did I write this drivel?" he joked as he looked at one journal. But the Blackwoods' son, who was there, recalled that Einstein was obviously deeply moved to have his books and papers in his hands. Ilse's death, accompanied in the summer of 1934 by Hitler's consolidation of power during the Night of the Long Knives, severed the Einstein's remaining bonds with Europe. Margot immigrated that year to Princeton, after she and her odd Russian husband separated. Hans Albert soon followed. "She was not longing for Europe at all," Elsa wrote Caroline Blackwood soon after returning. "I feel such a home-like feeling for this country." Recreations. When Elsa returned from Europe, she joined Einstein at a summer cottage he had rented in Watch Hill, Rhode Island, a quiet enclave on a peninsula near where Long Island Sound meets the Atlantic. It was perfect for sailing, which is why Einstein, at Elsa's urging, decided to summer there with his friend Gustav Bucky and his family. Bucky was a physician, engineer, inventor, and pioneer of X-ray technology. A German who had gained American citizenship during the 1920s, he had met the Einsteins in Berlin. When Einstein came to America, his friendship with Bucky deepened. They even took out a joint patent on a device they came up with to control a photographic diaphragm, and Einstein testified as an expert witness for Bucky in a dispute over another invention. His son Peter Bucky happily spent time driving Einstein around, and he later wrote down some of his recollections in extensive notebooks. They provide a delightful picture of the mildly eccentric but deeply unaffected Einstein in his later years. Peter tells, for example, of driving in his convertible with Einstein when it suddenly started to rain. Einstein pulled off his hat and put it under his coat. When Peter looked quizzical, Einstein explained, "You see, my hair has withstood water many times before, but I don't know how many times my hat can." Einstein relished the simplicity of life in Watch Hill. He puttered around its lanes and even shopped for groceries with Mrs. Bucky. Mostly, he loved sailing his 17-foot wooden boat, Tinef, which is Yiddish for a piece of junk. He usually went out on his own, aimlessly and often carelessly. Frequently, he would go all day long just drifting around, remembered a member of the local yacht club, who went to retrieve him on more than one occasion. He apparently was just out there meditating. As he had at Kaput, Einstein would drift with the breeze and sometimes scribble equations in his notebook when becalmed. "Once we all waited with growing concern for his return from an afternoon sail," Bucky recalls. "Finally, at 11 p.m., we decided to send the Coast Guard out to search for him. The guardsmen found him in the bay, not in the least concerned about his situation. At one point, a friend gave him an expensive outboard motor for emergency use. Einstein declined. He had a childlike delight about taking small risks. He still never took a life jacket, even though he could not swim, and escaping to where he could be by himself. To the average person, being becalmed for hours might be a terrible trial," said Bucky. To Einstein, this could simply have provided more time to think. The sailing rescue sagas continued the following summer, when the Einsteins began renting in Old Lyme, Connecticut, also on Long Island Sound. One such tale even made the New York Times. "Relative tide and sandbars trap Einstein," read the headline. The young boys who saved him were invited to the house for raspberry juice. Elsa loved the Old Lyme House, although both she and her family found it a bit too imposing. It was set on 20 acres, with a tennis court and swimming pool, and the dining room was so large that they initially were afraid to use it. "Everything is so luxurious here that the first 10 days, I swear to you, we ate in the pantry," Elsa wrote a friend. "The dining room was too magnificent for us." When the summers were over, the Einsteins would visit the Bucky family at their Manhattan home once or twice a month. Einstein would also stay, especially when he was by himself, at the home of the widower Leon Waters, the pharmaceutical company owner he had met in Pasadena. He once surprised Waters by arriving without a dressing gown or pajamas. "When I retire, I sleep as nature made me," he said. Waters recalled that he did, however, ask to borrow a pencil and notepad for his bedside. Out of both politeness and his touch of vanity, Einstein found it hard to decline requests from artists and photographers who wanted him to pose. One weekend in April 1935, when he was staying with Waters, Einstein sat for two artists in one day. His first session was with the wife of Rabbi Stephen Wise, not known for her artistic ability. Why was he doing it? "Because she's a nice woman," he answered. Later that day, Waters picked Einstein up to ferry him to Greenwich Village for a session with the Russian sculptor Sergei Kononkov, a practitioner of Soviet realism, who was producing what would be a distinguished bust of Einstein that is now at the Institute for Advanced Studies. Einstein had been introduced to Kononkov through Margot, who was also a sculptor. Soon, all of them became friends with his wife, Margarita Kononkova, who, unbeknown to Einstein, was a Soviet spy. In fact, Einstein would later become, after Elsa's death, romantically involved with her, which would end up creating, as we shall see, more complexities than he ever knew. Now that they had decided to stay in the United States, it made sense for Einstein to seek citizenship. When Einstein visited the White House, President Roosevelt had suggested that he should accept the offer of some congressman to have a special bill passed on his behalf. But Einstein instead decided to go through the normal procedures. That meant leaving the country so that he and Elsa, Margot, and Helen Dukas could come in not as visitors, but as people seeking citizenship. So, in May 1935, they all sailed on the Queen Mary to Bermuda for a few days to satisfy these formalities. The royal governor was there to greet them when they arrived in Hamilton, and he recommended the island's two best hotels. Einstein found them stuffy and pretentious. As they walked through town, he saw a modest guest cottage, and that is where they ended up. Einstein declined all official invitations from the Bermuda gentry and socialized instead with a German cook he met at a restaurant, who invited him to come sailing on his little boat. They were away for 7 hours, and Elsa feared that Nazi agents may have nabbed her husband. But she found him at the cook's home, where he had gone to enjoy a dinner of German dishes. That summer, a house down the block from the one they were renting in Princeton went on sale. A modest white clapboard structure that peeked through a little front yard onto one of the town's pleasant tree-lined arteries, 112 Mercer Street, was destined to become a world-famous landmark, not because of its grandeur, but because it so perfectly suited and symbolized the man who lived there. Like the public persona that he adopted in later life, the house was unassuming, sweet, charming, and unpretentious. It sat there right on a main street, highly visible yet slightly cloaked behind a veranda. Its modest living room was a bit overwhelmed by Elsa's heavy German furniture, which had somehow caught up with them after all their wanderings. Helen Dukas commandeered the small library on the first floor as a workroom in which she dealt with Einstein's correspondence and took charge of the only telephone in the house. Princeton 1606 was the unlisted number. Elsa oversaw the construction of a second-floor office for Einstein. They removed part of the back wall and installed a picture window that looked out on the long and lush backyard garden. Bookcases on both sides went up to the ceiling. A large wooden table, cluttered with papers and pipes and pencils, sat in the center with a view out of the window, and there was an easy chair where Einstein would sit for hours scribbling on a pad of paper in his lap. The usual pictures of Faraday and Maxwell were tacked on the walls. There was also, of course, one of Newton, although, after a while, it fell off its hook. To that mix was added a fourth, Mahatma Gandhi, Einstein's new hero, now that his passions were as much political as they were scientific. As a small joke, the only award displayed was a framed certificate of Einstein's membership in the Bern Scientific Society. Besides his menagerie of women, the household was joined over the years by various pets. There was a parrot named Bebo, who required an unjustifiable amount of medical care, a cat named Tiger, and a white terrier named Chico that had belonged to the Bucky family. Chico was an occasional problem. "The dog is very smart," Einstein explained. "He feels sorry for me because I receive so much mail. That's why he tries to bite the mailman." "The professor does not drive," Elsa often said. "It's too complicated for him." Instead, he loved to walk, or more precisely, shuffle up Mercer Street each morning to his office at the Institute. People often snapped their heads when he passed, but the sight of him walking lost in thought was soon one of the well-known attractions of the town. On his walk back home at midday, he would often be joined by three or four professors or students. Einstein would usually walk calmly and quietly, as if in a reverie, while they pranced around him, waved their arms, and tried to make their points. When they got to the house, the others would peel off, but Einstein sometimes just stood there thinking. Every now and then, unwittingly, he even started drifting back to the Institute. Dukas, always watching from her window, would come outside, take his arm, and lead him inside for his macaroni lunch. Then he would nap, dictate some answers to his mail, and pad up to his study for another hour or two of rumination about potential unified field theories. Occasionally he would take rambling walks on his own, which could be dicey. One day someone called the Institute and asked to speak to a particular dean. When his secretary said that the dean wasn't available, the caller hesitantly asked for Einstein's home address. That was not possible to give out, he was informed. The caller's voice then dropped to a whisper. "Please don't tell anybody," he said, "but I am Dr. Einstein. I'm on my way home, and I've forgotten where my house is." This incident was recounted by the son of the dean, but, like many of the tales about Einstein's distracted behavior, it may have been exaggerated. The absent-minded professor image fit him so nicely and naturally that it became reinforcing. It was a role that Einstein was happy to play in public and that his neighbors relished recounting. And like most assumed roles, there was a core of truth to it. At one dinner where Einstein was being honored, for example, he got so distracted that he pulled out his notepad and began scribbling equations. When he was introduced, the crowd burst into a standing ovation, but he was still lost in thought. Dukas caught his attention and told him to get up. He did, but noticing the crowd standing and applauding, he assumed it was for someone else and heartily joined in. Dukas had to come over and inform him that the ovation was for him. In addition to the tales of the dreamy Einstein, another common theme was that of the kindly Einstein helping a child, usually a little girl, with her homework. The most famous of these involved an 8-year-old neighbor on Mercer Street, Adelaide DeLong, who rang his bell and asked for help with a math problem. She carried a plate of homemade fudge as a bribe. "Come in," he said. "I'm sure we can solve it." He helped explain the math to her, but made her do her own homework. In return for the fudge, he gave her a cookie. After that, the girl kept reappearing. When her parents found out, they apologized profusely. Einstein waved them off. "That's quite unnecessary," he said. "I'm learning just as much from your child as she is learning from me." He loved to tell, with a twinkle in his eye, the tale of her visits. "She was a very naughty girl," he would laugh. "Do you know she tried to bribe me with candy?" A friend of Adelaide's recalled going with her and another girl on one of these visits to Mercer Street. When they got up to his study, Einstein offered them lunch, and they accepted. So he moved a whole bunch of papers from the table, opened 4 cans of beans with a can opener, and heated them on a Sterno stove one by one, stuck a spoon in each, and that was our lunch, she recalled. He didn't give us anything to drink. Later, Einstein famously told another girl who complained about her problems with math, "Do not worry about your difficulties in mathematics. I can assure you that mine are even greater." But lest it be thought he helped only girls, he hosted a group of senior boys from the Princeton Country Day School who were baffled by a problem on their math final exam. He also helped a 15-year-old boy at Princeton High School, Henry Rosso, who was doing poorly in a journalism course. His teacher had offered an A to anyone who scored an interview with Einstein, so Rosso showed up at Mercer Street but was rebuffed at the door. As he was slinking away, the milkman gave him a tip. Einstein could be found walking a certain route every morning at 9:30. So Rosso snuck out of school one day, positioned himself accordingly, and was able to accost Einstein as he wandered by. Rosso was so flummoxed that he did not know what to ask, which may have been why he was doing poorly in the course. Einstein took pity on him and suggested questions. "No personal topics," he insisted. "Ask about math instead." Rosso was smart enough to follow his advice. "I discovered that nature was constructed in a wonderful way, and our task is to find out the mathematical structure of the nature itself," Einstein explained of his own education at age 15. "It is a kind of faith that helped me through my whole life." The interview earned Rosso an A, but it also caused him a bit of dismay. He had promised Einstein that it would only be used in the school paper, but without his permission, it got picked up by the Trenton newspaper and then others around the world, which provided yet another lesson in journalism. Elsa's death. Soon after they moved into 112 Mercer Street, Elsa became afflicted with a swollen eye. Tests in Manhattan showed that it was a symptom of heart and kidney problems, and she was ordered to remain immobile in bed. Einstein sometimes read to her, but mostly he threw himself more intently into his studies. Strenuous intellectual work and looking at God's nature are the reconciling, fortifying, yet relentlessly strict angels that shall lead me through all of life's troubles, he had written to the mother of his first girlfriend. Then, as now, he could escape the complexity of human emotions by delving into the mathematical elegance that could describe the cosmos. "My husband sticks fearsomely to his calculations," Elsa wrote Waters. "I have never seen him so engrossed in his work." Elsa painted a warmer picture of her husband when writing to her friend Antonina Valentin. "He has been so upset by my illness," she reported. He wanders around like a lost soul. I never thought he loved me so much, and that comforts me." Elsa decided that they would be better off if they went away for the summer, as they usually did, and so they rented a cottage on Saranac Lake in the Adirondack Mountains of New York. "I'm certain to get better there," she said. "If my Ilse walked into my room now, I would recover at once." It turned out to be an enjoyable summer, but by winter, Elsa was again bedridden and getting weaker. She died on December 20th, 1936. Einstein was hit harder than he might have expected. In fact, he actually cried, as he had done when his mother died. "I had never seen him shed a tear," Peter Bucky reported. But he did then, as he sighed, "Oh, I shall really miss her." Their relationship had not been a model romance. Before their marriage, Einstein's letters to her were filled with sweet endearments, but those disappeared over the years. He could be prickly and demanding at times, seemingly inured to her emotional needs, and occasionally a flirt or more with other women. Yet beneath the surface of many romances that evolve into partnerships, there is a depth not visible to outside observers. Elsa and Albert Einstein liked each other, understood each other, and perhaps most important, for she too was actually quite clever in her own way, were amused by each other. So even if it was not the stuff of poetry, the bond between them was a solid one. It was forged by satisfying each other's desires and needs. It was genuine, and it worked in both directions. Not surprisingly, Einstein found solace in his work. He admitted to Hans Albert that focusing was difficult, but the attempt provided him the means to escape the painfully personal. "As long as I am able to work, I must not and will not complain, because work is the only thing that gives substance to life." When he came to the office, he was ashen with grief, his collaborator, Banach Hoffman, noted, but he insisted on delving into their work each day. He needed it more than ever, he said. At first, his attempts to concentrate were pitiful, Hoffman recalled. But he had known sorrow before, and he learned that work was a precious antidote. Together they worked that month on two major papers. One that explored how the bending of light by the gravitational fields of galaxies could create cosmic lenses that would magnify distant stars, and another that explored the existence of gravitational waves. Max Born learned of Elsa's death in a letter from Einstein in which it was mentioned almost as an afterthought in explaining why he had become less social. "I live like a bear in my cave, and really feel more at home than ever before in my eventful life," he told his old friend. "This bear-like quality has been further enhanced by the death of my woman comrade, who was better with other people than I am." Born later marveled at the incidental way in which Einstein broke the news of his wife's death. "For all his kindness, sociability, and love of humanity," commented Born, "he was nevertheless totally detached from his environment and the human beings in it." That was not entirely true. For a self-styled bear in a cave, Einstein attracted a clan wherever he went. Whether it was walking home from the Institute, puttering around 112 Mercer Street, or sharing summer cottages and Manhattan weekends with the Waters or Bucky families, Einstein was rarely alone, except when he trundled up to his study. He could keep an ironic detachment and retreat into his own reveries, but he was a true loner only in his own mind. After Elsa died, he still lived with Helen Dukas and his stepdaughter Margot, and soon thereafter his sister moved in. Maya had been living near Florence with her husband Paul Winterler. But when Mussolini enacted laws in 1938 that withdrew resident status from all foreign Jews, Maya moved to Princeton on her own. Einstein, who loved her dearly and liked her immensely, was thrilled. Einstein also encouraged Hans Albert, now 33, to come to America, at least for a visit. Their relationship had been rocky, but Einstein had come to admire the diligence of his son's engineering work, especially regarding the flow of rivers, a topic he had once studied himself. He had also changed his mind and encouraged his son to have children, and he was now happy to have two young grandsons. In October 1937, Hans Albert arrived for a three-month stay. Einstein met him at the pier, where they posed for photographs, and Hans Albert playfully lit a long Dutch pipe he had brought his father. "My father would like me to come here with my family," he said. "You know, his wife died recently, and he is all alone now." During the visit, young and eager Peter Bucky offered to drive Hans Albert across America so that he could visit universities and seek positions as an engineering professor. The trip, which covered 10,000 miles, took them to Salt Lake City, Los Angeles, Iowa City, Knoxville, Vicksburg, Cleveland, Chicago, Detroit, and Indianapolis. Einstein reported to Mileva Maric how much he enjoyed being with their son. "He has such a great personality," he wrote. "It is unfortunate that he has this wife, but what can you do if he's happy?" Einstein had written Frieda a few months earlier and suggested that she not accompany her husband on the trip. But with his affection for Hans Albert fully restored, Einstein urged both of them to return together the following year with their two children and stay in America. They did. Hans Albert found a job studying soil conservation at a U.S. Department of Agriculture extension station in Clemson, South Carolina, where he became an authority on alluvial transport by rivers. Displaying his father's taste, he built a simple wooden house, reminiscent of that in Caput, in nearby Greenville, where he applied for American citizenship in December 1938. While his father was becoming more connected to his Jewish heritage, Hans Albert became, under the influence of his wife, a Christian Scientist. The rejection of medical care, as sometimes entailed by that faith, had tragic results. A few months after their arrival, their 6-year-old son Klaus contracted diphtheria and died.